This is Audible.
A virtuous woman who can find, for her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband trusteth in her, and he shall have no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. Proverbs chapter 31, verses 10 through 12.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents A Virtuous Woman by Kay Gibbons. Read by Terry Beaver and Kay Gibbons.
She hasn't been dead 4 months, and I've already eaten to the bottom of the deep freeze. I even ate the green peas. Used to, I wouldn't turn my hand over for green peas. My whole name is Blinkin' Jack Ernest Stokes. Stokes of fire, Stokes of stove, Stokes of fiery furnace of hell. I've got a nerve problem in back of the face, so I blink. June nicknamed me for it when she is little. My wife's name was Ruby Pitt Woodrow Stokes. She was a real pretty woman. I used to lay up in bed and say, "Don't take it off in the dark. I want to see it all." Ruby died with lung cancer in March. She wasn't but 45. Young woman to die so early. She used to tell me, she'd say, "What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I imagine I'll stop smoking about the time you stop drinking." June's daddy, Burr, told me one time people feed on each other's bad habits, which might could be true except for one thing. I'm not really what I would call a drinking man. I hardly ever take a drink except when I need one. But Ruby died, and they laid her out and crossed her hands over her bosom, and I said to them, "I never saw her sleeping like that." They said, "But that's the way everybody was laid." So I said, "Fine, then, I'll let her be." I did lean over in the coffin, though, and fix her fingers so the nicotine stains wouldn't show. Ruby had the creamiest soft skin, and I hated to have brown spots ruin her for people. Suppose you went to view somebody who died being shot or stabbed somewhere so you'd notice. Don't you know they'd fill in with some kind of spackle and smooth it over to match him? Sure they would. Same thing, only different, with Ruby's two ashy-smelling fingers. God, you ought to have seen her in the hospital. Weak, trying to sit up, limp as a dish rag. She'd lost down so much, looked like she'd literally almost shook all the meat off, all that coughing and spewing up she'd done. I sat with her long as they'd let me that night. Then I had to leave. I stuck my head up under her tent and said to her, "Night, night, Ruby. I'm headed back to the Ponderosa with Burr. I'll see you first thing in the morning." Then she put those two ashy-smelling fingers up to her mouth, like either she was blowing me a kiss or telling me to hush a little. And while I was looking at her and trying to figure out which one she meant, I realized she wasn't motioning love or to hush me. She was wanting a cigarette, asking me for one. I thought, well, I will be damned. And I said, "Hard as that woman worked to get over too good a life, then too bad a life, what a pity, what a shame to see this now." I hated to, but I had to call it selfish. Not like the Ruby I knew. But I suppose when you're that bad off and you're not here, not gone either, I suppose you can get to the point that you are all that matters to yourself, and thinking about yourself is the last thing left you can remember how to do. So you're bound to go on and forgive it. And after it all, after it's all said and done, I'll still have to say bless you, Ruby. You were a fine partner, and I miss you.
By Thanksgiving, I'll have everything organized. A Thai package of pork with some corn, beef with some beans, and so forth. So all Jack should have to do is reach into the freezer and take out a good, easy meal. This should help him. When I was out on the back porch working on that this morning, I thought about how somebody, especially somebody who doesn't know us, would say, "That's the most morbid thing I've ever heard of." But there'd be others who'd say, "That Ruby sure is smart to make sure her husband's well-fed when she's gone." I don't know. I can't do much, but I can do something. There's not a whole lot a woman can do from the grave. Another thing, I wish I could go back to the day I was diagnosed and change everything about it, not just the news, but the way Jack took the news and the way I handled him. He's so good to me, but when he said what he did that day, I wanted to turn on him, against him. Sometimes we all could use a lesson in keeping quiet. Hard as it is, sometimes we need to hold back. He should have. I should have. We came home from the doctor's office, and I sat down with some coffee. He sat down with me, and I said, "What do you think's going to happen to me? You know how you turn to somebody you love so they can help you." But all he said was, "Shoot, woman, not a damn thing. Anybody mean as the old squaw outlive everybody." What'd he think? Did he expect me to laugh, slap my leg, and say, "Ain't it the truth? I'm not dying. I'm not even sick." But I didn't. I cried. I cried and heaved and sobbed and wouldn't let him touch me. When he wanted to know what was going on, I told him I didn't need his cheering up, that I was upset enough without him insulting me. He yelled at me, "Insulting?" And then he asked if I wanted him to call the undertaker and have him cart me off ahead of schedule, or if I planned just to leave then and crawl out into the woods and wait for it to happen. I told him how far off the mark he was, how I wished he could get something right for once. Then I saw his face change, and I saw how badly I'd hurt him. See, there's something raw and right there on the surface with him. Sometimes I swear he's just like a child. You have to be so careful. You can't ever just throw words out. They have to land somewhere, and they land on him, and there he is so raw from the way he was raised, and then it's too late. I kept to myself the rest of the day, kept all my thoughts to myself, and I hate to say it, but sometimes I just wanted to yank him and say, "Didn't you know cheering me up would do more harm than good? What possessed you to do the wrong thing when I needed the right thing the most? I don't ask for much from you. Can't you see that anything less than not exactly right hurts worse than I already hurt? You've got to cure me or either love me so strongly that I feel some of this pain pass from me. Those are the only things you have any business doing right now." I think about Jack that day I was diagnosed, and it all comes back clear as you please. My grandmother in the hospital. When she finally became too ill to be looked after at home, my parents helped Big Daddy find a nursing hospital for her. She'd always lived right next door to us, and I got so lonesome for her that Daddy let me spend the weekends with her. Big Daddy'd always get there first thing Saturday morning. He'd pull a chair up by the bed and say, "How are you today, Sophie?" She'd never answer him. He'd take her arm and pat and rub it back and forth, and then she'd jerk it away like he'd burned her. Then he'd realize he was rubbing the place where she'd had so many shots. But he'd take that arm and do the same thing every single visit, same thing, not thinking. Then he'd take his hat off and place it on his lap, reverently, like he was in a church, not his church, but some unfamiliar church she felt a little awkward in. She'd moan, trying to lift her head up to say something to him. Then he'd start talking, saying something about her nice begonias or her nice game hens or how nice her herb garden looked with the dew on it from that morning or how fine a job Eloise was doing keeping everything just like she liked it. And then one time she got her head up off her pillow and she turned her face full to him and said in the hatefulest tone you can imagine, "Shut up, go straight to hell, leave me alone." Big Daddy looked like she'd shot him, and he turned around to me to see if I could help him, tell him how he should react or jump in there for him. I didn't know what to do. She'd always been such a calm woman. But I'd know what to do now, and she knew what she needed then. But if you have to tell somebody, then it doesn't count. It just doesn't. It's like sending yourself flowers on a birthday and signing the name of the man you love on the card. If I could, I'd go back there and tell Big Daddy to lift her shoulders off that bed and hold her and forget every last thing he'd always thought was best to say in times like these. See, he thought that bringing her the things from home up close to her would make her feel better, as if she'd ever be back there, back on the beam. But she knew that those game hens scratching around in the yard were a whole life away from her, and he thought that by filling up that damp-smelling hospital room and her mind with all those things that we could all just pretend everything would be fine. Everything's going to be just fine. But she was dying, and it's not fair pretending. It's a bigger cheat than having to die. If you want to see a man afraid, just put him in a room with a sick woman who was once strong. See, I know now that this world is built up on strong women, built up and kept up by them too. Them kneeling, stooping, pulling, bending, and rising up when they need to go and do what needs to get done. And when a man sees a woman like that sick and hurt, especially the kind of man who knows a woman's strength but can't confess it, when he sees her sick or hurt, it terrifies him, like he's witnessing a chunk of the universe coming loose, and he knows he doesn't have what it takes to stick it back together. And that man will feel guilty and foolish then too, because he never made himself say what he always knew. So a man will see things coming apart, and all he can do is rush to it and hide the broken, chipped-off wrong piece. He'll slip it under something to pretend, or hope to pretend, it's not there, not one bit different from when a child hides a special toy he's broken. That's all my grandfather was guilty of, fear, faith in his words, but that was a high crime in her eyes. That's all Jack was guilty of that day, but I'd lived with him a good while, and I believe I understand him. Sometimes it might take an afternoon or evening of being here in this kitchen alone, thinking, but I can usually come to see his reasons through his ways. And half the job of finding peace is finding understanding. Don't you believe it to be so?
Ruby was the first and last woman I ever loved, outside of my mama. Not meaning it to sound like she is one bit like Mama, though. Mama was a tough, hard woman, skin like cat tongue. You didn't run to be up next to her if she'd let you. It was her that'd say to come here, and she'd stand me between her knees and scrub the backs of my ears with an old rag and box lye soap. And she'd run a comb through my hair so hard I'd swear my head was bleeding. No, she wasn't a hugging kind of Mama. I imagine it's all the Indian in her made her like she was. I don't know how she and my daddy got up together. It wasn't something they sat around our house and went over. I have to see him proposing to her something like, "You need to marry me." And then he probably pulled her over up next to him and took her to a holiness preacher for him to marry him. My daddy always was a holiness man, always trying to shove Jesus down I and Mama's throats. He drug me to church and tent revivals with him until I got too big to be beat into going. He'd start on Mama on a Sunday morning, and she'd walk outside and slam the door in his face talking. Same thing every Sunday the sun rose. She passed when I was 14, food poison. Turned out to be a bad piece of meat, but we thought first it was just a stomach flu. By the time Daddy found out about the meat, she was sick as a dog, just got sicker and sicker, and couldn't anybody do a damn thing about it. There I was, a boy, and watching her and wanting to ask Daddy, "Where's he now?" I'd always have to think of my mama whenever Ruby made a pie, which is every Sunday morning until she got so weak she couldn't hardly crawl out of the bed. She'd always hold that pie up on one hand and turn it round and round very slow and put a crimp in the crust with a butter knife. Mama would have been put off by Ruby's pies. Too much, too good. She wouldn't have said a word, though, if she'd walked in on Ruby crimping one. She'd have just gazed at that pie and walked out. Sometimes now, even with me being as old a man as I am, sometimes I want to ask Mama why she couldn't ever have made I and Daddy just one pie, just a plain one. But I just guess a hard woman like my Mama didn't think about dessert. That's all okay now. I lived a long time with a soft woman and her soft way of doing things. I excused the pies I didn't have because I was satisfied by Ruby's so many times. I know people generally think if you act like Ruby, do like she used to and all, I know they think you're bound to have had it easy all along, not like Mama, not like a man either that walks around with his fists up all the time because he knows he'd better. But think that about Ruby and be dead wrong. Burr's ex-wife, Tiny Fran, despised Ruby for carrying herself like she is somebody. And I said to Burr one time, I said, you know, it shows a bad weakness in a woman when all she can do is find fault, be ridiculing. And all he is able to do is say, I know it. Tiny Fran's hard on everybody but herself and Roland. Roland's her old jailbird boy. But see, the thing about Ruby is her mama and daddy might have been able to give her a nice, easy road to go down when she is little. But the minute she could, she lit out of there and hit a skid. Big skid named John Woodrow. Now, I just have to shake my head at how it didn't kill her, that taking that wide turn off that easy road. He's the one that showed her how to smoke, damn his soul. Sometimes I wished I'd been the one to kill him. Lord God, I think of them married and I see that little shack he had her in, and then I see buzzards flying round and round the chimney, waiting to swoop down and take what'd be left of them when the way they were living finished with them. And then I see me, the biggest buzzard of them all, circling too, circling Ruby, waiting. I think about it and think how it's odd how it all lined up for me. All that grief and misery lining up into something so good. There her husband was about dead, then dead, and there I was, ready, willing, more than willing to hop in his spot and have her for my own. Everybody encouraged me. They all said you ought not to let that girl slip away out from under you, not with you a good man and needing a wife. Everybody, Burr, everybody at the store, they all said how if I played my cards right, I might could have her. And I did, and I never regretted it, not even now with her powder smell and her cooking smell and the way she could talk to me, not even with all that gone, gone buried with her in the grave. All I hate is being back to being by myself. Ruby got left out here by herself. Mama and Daddy on the other end of the state, and she too ashamed to go back home. I told her long as she is here, she might as well stay, and she did. All the whole time, I was hoping it wasn't showing through how I meant not just to stay, but to stay with me, marry me. To tell the truth, I'd have to say I thought I'd bust before I got to her house that night to tell her that old sorry John Woodrow was dead. See, I'd been the one to tell her he'd been hurt, cut, and I said to myself, carrying her the news of him dying, being there with his shoulder and so forth, this would be good, timely. This ought to get me in good. Think what you will. Shock, shock, I don't give a damn. If I gave a damn, I would have kept it to myself. I had to do what I had to do. See, a man like me does what he needs to do more often than he wants to. And I saw Ruby, and I had to have her. Needed her. She is the most gorgeous thing I'd ever seen in my life. Sitting under Lonnie Hoover's big pecan tree that morning like a prize. And the thought of me going long as I had without one made me think, started me to think that I might could try for this girl. You get to be 40 out here, and you think about things like chances and prizes pass by, dried up, You drying up and passing without somebody to love and love you back. She wasn't but 20 then and me 40, and it was almost 5 months from the day I met her that I married her. I know what it sounds like an old lecher got him a child bride when her first husband wasn't even cold yet. Go ahead and think it. It just shows how much you don't know me or Ruby. But Lord, did she evermore have one sorry time with John Woodrow. It embarrassed her to tell me all how she lived, like I'd judge her for it and think less of her. No, Ruby, I loved you more. He made her live in one fallen-down place right after the other. Migrant houses, trailers, places he scrounged up for him to rent. And half the time he wouldn't work. They'd have to depend on what she could go out and do and bring in. That's sorriness. A woman, especially one built small like Ruby, has about as much business picking cucumbers as a child does. Ruby said one day she came in from the field and found John Woodrow laid up with some old greasy gal, and there's a baby greasy as his mama crawling around on the floor. I asked her what she did, and she said she took and left and went and bought a pistol from a man and came back aiming to shoot him. I thought, Lord God, I featured Ruby going up to somebody buying a pistol, and it scared me to death. But she never got the chance to shoot him. I've got the pistol now. I use it to blow cans off the top of the trash barrel. A few years ago, I joined the NRA. People don't want to believe I've got my card, but I've got one. Ruby took and had plastic put on because she said I was going to wear it out, taking it out of my wallet so much. Seems like I'm always having to take something out and show somebody the truth about something they don't want to believe. I guess if you have on a new suit or drive a new car or live in town, you might could get somebody to believe you. But Ruby always said that my talking loud wouldn't make people listen to me any better than if I talk regular. She said people usually decide by looking at you if they think what you have to say is worth a hoot. And she told me you can't change that because you can't change people, and that's that, and you have to just go on and do the best you can with it. I think that's a damn shame in this world.
I've never told Jack this. I wouldn't spoil his time for anything in the world, but every single time I hear that gun go off, all I can think of is John Woodrow. I know if Jack had any idea that was happening, especially now with me sick, I know he'd sell the gun or give it away. I can see him out the kitchen window, just on the edge of the pines, taking aim. He couldn't hit the broadside of a barn, but that's never seemed to bother him. He really latched on to that pistol. At first I didn't think anything of it, but lately when he goes out there, it's all I can do to keep from running out and grabbing it and pitching it into the woods and daring him to go in and find it. Then I get upset and he comes back in, looks at me and says, "What's the matter with you, Ruby?" And what do I say? I say, "I just missed you, that's all." Well, it may not be the whole truth, but it gets us by. Then he'll kiss me. He doesn't make light of tears anymore. But talk about truth. What truth did I ever have with John Woodrow? None. I don't believe he ever spoke a word of truth to me, except maybe when he thought a dash of the truth might get him what he wanted. Why'd I marry him? I think part of the reason is that I didn't have enough sense to say no, plain and simple. I'm not saying I was ignorant. I knew the difference between right and wrong, but it was a vague sort of knowing, and it didn't occur to me that what I was doing that second, the second it took to tell John Woodrow I'd marry him, was terribly wrong, the kind of wrong that can ruin your life. Deep down, though, I must have suspected something wasn't quite right, or why would I have waited until my father and brothers were working in the farthest field before I packed my bags? I'd rehearsed the question all through my childhood, and I dreamed of it coming, but I just didn't know when I could expect it. All I knew for sure was that somehow I became available at 16, And I said, one day a man's going to come along and say the kindest things to me and buy me things, and then he'll say something on the order of, come live with me and be my love. I had the two of us on my long porch, moon shining through the trees and so forth. And who was the first one to come along and pay me a bit of attention but John Woodrow? I was 18, just graduated from high school. I'd planned to enter a Presbyterian college the next fall and study piano. It was about the only thing I knew how to do. But John Woodrow was 26 and not a thing going for him but his looks. I might could say he had his brains working for him, but he put his smarts to such a bad use that I wouldn't feel right calling him intelligent. He's the only person I've ever known, except maybe Roland Stanley, who'd lie when telling the truth would do him more good. Now, can you call that smart? And what about me? He lied to me, and I ate up every word that came out of his mouth. Oh, he was a hoodlum through and through, and there I was, lonesome, bored to tears, and there was my family, my mama and my daddy and my two big brothers, loving me like I was a big baby doll. I remember how hard I watched him all the first week he worked. I'd cut through the yard when he was out there just to see him better, so he could see me. Then my girlfriend and I saw him with a couple of other workers in town in the movie lobby. And I remember pointing him out to Jean Ann, and she said, he looks just like Tab Hunter. Just clean him up a little, put some pleated pants on him, and he's just a spitting image. I think that right that minute I shaped his hair, cleaned his fingernails, took a tuck in his pants here and there, and got the idea of him that stayed with me until after we were married, when the bad times started. Looking back on it all, I think the mistake I made with John Woodrow had more to do with the careful way my family raised me than anything else. Growing up, I had absolutely no idea anything bad could happen in a life because nothing bad had happened in mine. No catastrophes. My grandmother died, but Mama and Daddy helped me through it, and had spent so much time with her, watching her get weaker and weaker, that I felt like dying was the next step for her, something that naturally should happen next. But worse than my ignorance of any bad coming into a life was the fact that I didn't have the imagination, the pure imagination, to see that hard or ugly things might happen farther on down the road. I was just whistling along. I can't remember making decisions on my own. My parents protected me from bad choices by making the choices for me, and a lot of it had to do with me being the baby girl in the family. My mama was the kind of woman who believed girls in girl clothes are less apt to get in trouble than girls dressed like boys. I remember begging her for some pants to play outside in, and when she finally made me some, she sewed eyelets around the cuffs, just a bit of girl on those pants. And my daddy and brothers were just as bad. If I had a tough piece of meat on my plate, the minute one of them saw me struggling, they'd lean over, take my knife and fork from me, and cut the meat up for me. I never rebelled against it, snatched my knife back and said, I'll cut up my own meat, thank you. All the women in my family were calm women. They wouldn't have said a word. It was just the way things were. The only woman I knew who wasn't calm was Sudie B., our housekeeper. She ran the house for Mama, and how could she do all she did and not get ruffled, not make some decisions and some mistakes? I just hated that the first big decision I ever made was the kind that can kill you if you make a mistake, and it almost killed me. When John Woodrow asked me to marry him, I might as well have been in a school play, hearing what I thought was my cue and asking the teacher, is this when I say my part? And she says to go ahead, so I say, yes, yes, I will. Then everybody's supposed to clap and nod and sing your praises, and then they throw rice at you on your way out, and you take all your pretty presents and put them in his car and drive off. But that's not the way it turned out. Play, marriage, nothing. I can see Mama on the front steps yelling that she's going to go find my daddy and brothers and tell them to come stop me. But I tell her I've already decided I'm leaving with him, and I roll up the car window so I don't have to hear her. I can see her, though. John Woodrow drives this old car he's borrowed all up on the lawn, turning around, and we leave Mama there crying. I was crying too, but I thought Tom would take care of me, that once we had our rings and a nice honeymoon hotel, that everything would be just fine. I'd call Daddy and we'd chat just like Elizabeth Taylor and Spencer Tracy in Father of the Bride, one of those daydreamy movies that had contributed to the mess I was in. But that didn't happen. I got no ring, no nice honeymoon hotel, just a quickie thrown together mess and humiliation. As soon as I left my mama, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know how I'd gotten myself into this, and I surely didn't know how to get myself out. That sort of thing comes from one too many suppers of having someone reach over to cut your meat for you. I'm not saying it's their fault. My parents did a fine job raising us, the kind of job that most people say they plan to do, but just don't have it in them to ever get done. But they sure had it, all the love and strength day in and day out. And even though they never taught me to handle the kinds of decisions I'd need to make about John Woodrow, they did teach me self-respect, and self-respect should have protected me from John Woodrow's advances. I should have said, "Ruby, you love yourself and your home too much to insult either one with this excuse of a man," but I didn't. Oh, but I had enough self-respect to pack my nicest underwear and my pretty gown and robe set, and I thought enough of myself to make sure I was clean and powdery for the trip away from home. And I also had enough self-respect left to cry when he ripped my robe and my gown and pawed at my nice underwear. And there was enough left to tell him not to do that anymore, that he'd hurt me. But I more than made up for that in ignorance and dreaming, believing him when he said he was sorry and believing every other lie he told me. See, he had me convinced he came from something, that the only reason he was working migrant labor was because his brother and sister had ruined him. He said they made sure he didn't get his cut of his daddy's farm, talked him down to their father and so forth, made up a pack of lies and got themselves good and set up. And then when their father died, poor John Woodrow was left out in the cold. He was a real victim, which then to me was the exact same thing as a real hero, only different, as Jack would say. He said he was trying to work his way back up from the bottom, but so far the only good to come from his efforts was me. That if he hadn't been working on Daddy's farm that summer, we never would have met. See, Daddy had added extra acreage that spring, and our usual help wasn't nearly enough to manage the crop, so he had to do something he didn't want to, hire migrant labor. They stayed in a camp a few miles from our house, and every morning at dawn an old rusted truck would pull up under the big sycamore tree, and what looked to me like 100 men and women would crawl out of it and go spread out on the grass and sleep until Daddy and Lester took them to the fields. And I can remember standing at the kitchen window with Mama, and she'd look out at them and comment on how dusty and dirty they all looked for it to be so early in the day. I don't think she ever accepted the fact that not everybody in the world takes or even wants a nice hot tub bath before bed. And I know this now as well as I know myself. If my daddy had known I'd take up with one of those men sleeping in that yard, he'd have let the crops burn in the fields before he'd have let a migrant worker on his farm. I can also remember the first day they worked and how Sooty B told Mama she'd better send to the store for some picnic plates to feed them on. She said they would break Mama's good things, and to be safe, we'd better fix the buffet on the table outside and let them eat in the yard. Mama said that wouldn't be necessary, that she had more than enough serving pieces and so forth. There was plenty of room around the long table on the side porch. Sooty B just said, "Go ahead and get your family's dish plates busted up. See if Sooty B cares." I listened to both sides, and I had to agree with Mama. These people would be tired, hot, hungry, and they'd appreciate a cool porch and a square meal. And all the time I was helping Sooty B get the dishes down, she was mumbling things like, "She be coming up saying she gwine listen to old Sooty B next time, all them dish plates busted up." We set a good table for them, and then the three of us started our lunch in the kitchen. When Mama heard them coming up in the yard, she went to the side door and yelled for them to come in, that there was more than a plenty, and they should come in and eat and make themselves right at home. Sudie B said she quite find out, be like telling the pig family make themselves at home. But they came on in, and when we heard water running in the utility sink, Mama looked at Sudie B and said, see, they're washing up. Sudie B said that's what it sounded like, and that Lester'd be in that utility room all night mopping up the flood and fixing up the stopped drain pipe. Mama didn't say anything back, but I knew she was thinking Sudie B had too little faith in her fellow man. I knew she was because I was thinking that myself, and I was my mama's girl. When they left, we went out there, and Sudie B just stood at the end of the porch and said, you be listening to me next time. Plates on the floor, under the table, in the chairs, food everywhere, butter turned out in the tea pitcher, not to mention the mess in the utility room, towels crammed in the toilet, and so forth. Sudie B started scraping and stacking dirty plates, motioning up and down the window ledges with a fork at how most of the leaves had been stripped off the ferns. And the only time I can remember hearing my mama swear was when she saw they'd used her African violet for an ashtray. She used to water the roots of that plant with a syringe. The next day, Sudie B made big platters of sandwiches and potato chips, and I helped put everything out on the picnic table. But you can bet Mama didn't help. She stayed in her bedroom reading most of the morning. She'd been stung, and she knew it, and she didn't want to be up close to those people until she knew she was ready, and a person like my mama is never ready. We saw what people who don't care can do to people who do care about things, even if those things are only glasses and plates. What the things are, what they're worth in dollars, all that just isn't the point. But instead of running away from it like Mama did, I rushed to it and tried to forgive and understand it. That's all very well and good. That's a perfectly fine way to be. But not if one of those men out there urinating all over your mama's rose bushes has his eye on you. That eating outside business was one of the things John Woodrow started throwing up in my face when we'd been married not more than a week or two. He said it showed how my family was too uppity, too picky, and way, way too rich. And nothing I could have told him would have ever changed his mind about us. But like a fool, I kept trying. I should have known he was lying about his own past as soon as he started ridiculing mine. But sometimes the hardest things in the world to see are the ones that are right up on you. Somebody could say, if she loved her family so much, why didn't she run away and call someone to come get her? I thought about it 100 times a day, believe you me. Sometimes that was all I had to think about except how my body hurt. What would I have said? Daddy, did you ever hear of Tobacco Road? Well, the situation I'm in is a lot like that, only we're moving from place to place, and I'm never sure where I am. So next summer, when the migrants sit under our sycamore tree, don't think of anyone else but me, okay, Daddy? Toward the end of the first winter with John Woodrow, he got on a wild loop about putting some money together and moving us to a town somewhere, being a family and so forth. He'd talk about it all night long, and when I finally asked him how he intended to raise the money, since it took everything we made to live, he said I was going to call Daddy and ask him for my third of the inheritance early. I told him that was the craziest thing I'd ever heard, but that wasn't what he wanted to hear from me. Not after he'd spent all winter spending Daddy's money in that twisted-up head of his. I told him what he should do is call his own family, that they might be ready to make up for the trouble they'd caused him, that they might be feeling bad about what they'd done. It made sense to me. I was ready to get out of the mess we were living in myself, and I thought I was just helping him find another way to get that done. You should have seen how he blew up at me, saying how stupid I was and so forth. And then one thing led to another, and I found out all I needed to know about John Woodrow and his lies and traps, and how much trouble a girl can get into believing in the movies. This was the situation. About the only truth he told me about his family was that they hated him as much as he hated them. That's where the truth started and stopped both. And then he let it all out. He said he'd gone after his daddy with a butcher knife and missed, but he left and came back that night and burned every tobacco barn on the place to the ground. And it also came out that the farm was hardly big enough to support them, hardly anything worth dividing among three children. He said he was sent up 3 years for arson, and when he finally got out, his family wouldn't claim him, even put him under a peace bond, which he broke when he stole his sister's car and ran it up a telephone pole. That's how he got the long scar by his knee. Not in the high school football game he described to me that first night we slept together, which makes my skin crawl to even think about now. About then is when I started smoking. He'd ridicule me for not having any vices to speak of ever since we were married. He'd say, "I bet little Miss Vanderbilt don't even take liquor in her mint julep." I'd never even seen a mint julep, but I know he was picturing me sipping one out on our long porch, long crinoline dress, Sudie B. fanning and fetching for me, Lester down at the other end shining Paul in Jimmy's shoes. That's how his mind worked. But see, before we were married, no vices were more of a virtue, or so he made it seem. I think now how I lit up that first cigarette because I was sick of listening to him, and I smoked the second one because I liked the way I felt after the first one. And all through that winter and on up until 2 months ago, I smoked like a fiend. The reasons for doing it left, but that never mattered. It's funny how something I used so long ago to get me by, a way ahead of coping with things, it's just funny how it stayed with me to hurt me. And I let it, and ashamed as I am to say, I'd die for a cigarette right now, but that's been taken care of. This would hurt my mama. But the rest of that winter with him and on into the spring, I talked myself into calling home and then talked myself right back out of it, smoking one cigarette right after another, chewing my fingernails to the quick. Then the hotter it got, the iller he seemed to get at me. I remember how grateful I felt when he started staying in town all night. Whenever we got to a new place, he would sniff out a pool hall and be headed there before I was in the door good. And I'd be there left over from this big mess of a dream I'd put together without seeing that there wasn't any way it was going to turn out. And I was left there in it, with it. Going to the Hoover's farm turned out to be the salvation, although it sure didn't look that way from the car window. All those tobacco fields hot and thick, and I said to myself driving by, if I have to work another day in that nasty, sticky heat, I will surely die. I'd never seen it so hot. But then no sooner than we got unpacked, John Woodrow took off without a word. He stayed gone all night, and when he didn't show up the next morning, the crew chief said that made the third time and he was fired. And I thought, well, Ruby, you asked for it. Then he told me I was going to help in the house, and I should stay around in the yard and wait for the Hoover women to wake up and come get me. I know he was thinking I'd look better in the big house than any of the others, and he probably also thought I looked like I didn't have the gall to steal anything. That's a high recommendation. Frances Hoover called me inside a little later and told me she wanted this and that clean, and she said, when I say clean, I mean clean. She said her daughter was getting married there that next week, and she expected everything to be done just right. I started in the kitchen, and while I was mopping the pantry, I heard her yell up the stairs, "Tiny Fran, get your Majesty's self down here and help with this cleaning. I mean it. I'm not telling you again." And then I heard somebody yell from the top of the stairs, "Irie, told you I'm sick." Then Frances started again, "You get down here." And they went back and forth yelling at each other until Frances popped her dustcloth on the banister and stomped up the stairs. The next thing I heard was skin being slapped. Tiny Fran came downstairs. The stairs were in the kitchen, and I could see she wasn't the one who'd been slapped. She looked real pleased with herself, and all I could think was, my God, that girl just hit her mama. Then she went to the refrigerator and poured herself a big glass of chocolate milk, saw me standing by the pantry, and said to me, Hand me a box of soda crackers in there. I feel like shit this morning. And who the hell are you? I told her my name and that I was there to help her mama. When I got her crackers, she snatched them from me and said, "Well, good. That woman needs all the help she can get." I was just amazed. I didn't know what I'd walked in on, that topsy-turvy house. What a time I was to have with Tiny Fran. Everything she touched seemed to come out wrong, be it her fault or not. Nothing worked out. But ever since we met that day, at least she's had somebody to blame. She lives in town now. I haven't seen her for a long time. But I wouldn't be half surprised to hear that when she drops an egg or burns the butter, she screams out, "Damn you, Ruby Stokes." I wouldn't be surprised at all. She never came very far from where she was the day we met, mad at the whole world, settling her stomach with soda crackers and undoing all the good she was doing with a quart of chocolate milk, then sick again and frustrated and not knowing why.
I'd be lying if I didn't say how the reason I had to wait so long to get married is nobody would have me. And it's not like I gave a crowd of women the opportunity to turn me down. I never asked a one. I never came close to asking. Until I met Ruby, I suppose the sweetest thing I'd ever ask a woman to do for me was to hold the mule still while I hitched the plow to him. I had the big mouth with Ruby, though, going all into how I'd been waiting for the right one to come along, saving myself and so forth. She could have looked right in my face and said, "Bullshit, you were born a dried-up skinny man, and here you are expecting me to think you let a world of women pass you by, more plowboy than playboy." But she didn't laugh at me. All she said was she wanted somebody to take care of her, and if I promised to, she'd marry me. I said then, I say now, that's the best thing in the world for me, for both of us, best thing for anybody to do for somebody. You hear tell of somebody saying how so-and-so made him feel like a real man, how so-and-so made somebody feel like a natural woman, and so forth. It's all the time on television and the radio. You hear all about that, and I can honestly say that before I married Ruby, I'd felt like a boy. On the outside, looking in. But Ruby, when she loved me, I said, "This is what it must feel like to be a man." Before then, if somebody'd walked up to me and asked me right out who I was, I'd have said, "A tenant. One of the boys the Hoovers use." But now I'd say, "I'm the man that was married to Ruby." I was hauling manure to the garden the day I came across her sitting under the tree. And I thought how perfect a picture she'd make if she'd have had a flower or some sewing, something womany in her hand besides a cigarette. So I went right up to her, running on pure gall or what must have already been love, and I spoke to her on her smoking. You'd think that with somebody, a stranger like her, all of a sudden there one morning in the yard I'd been hauling manure across all my life, you'd think I'd be too bound up to breathe, much less speak. But I didn't bind up. I leaped right in. I didn't bind up hardly at all. And when she talked to me, it was none of this twisting and twirling of the hair and this and that kind of eye batting. No, she just talked to me like she knew I didn't mean her harm. Not out there in the yard, not ever. I thought, talking to her, I thought, this is the kind of woman I could get along with. Ruby, you're my kind of woman. So I looked at her good and listened to her lie to me and thought how she is the kind of woman, girl really, that some tough somebody'd love to chew up and spit out. After she told me how she is married and had a husband and his name was John Woodrow and all, I said, "Well, I ought to tell her what I heard. I ought to." So I did. It'd like to have shocked her. Then I said, "Well, you told her. The least you can do is offer to help her out." So I told her where all I lived and to come on if she needed something. She acted like she would. Then about that time I heard Tiny Fran stick her head out and yell at her, "Come on in here and find where you laid the soda crackers yesterday. I'm sick as a dog this morning." I thought to myself, just like Tiny Fran to be yelling her old sorry business out the back door, and I said, I sure hope it doesn't take this girl long to get Tiny Fran's number. You always needed her number to handle her, to try to anyway. I didn't know back then that handling Tiny Fran was something Ruby'd have to do more often than she'd have liked to. But now I think I can look back to that first day with Ruby and feel like it was the whole start of many more things than that. Sometimes I feel like everything started with Ruby.
I got things sufficiently clean for Frances. All day she kept after Tiny Fran to help me, but she kept telling her mama things like scrubbing floors wasn't in her job description. I worked around her most of the day. Sometimes it seemed like she intentionally put herself in my way, so I'd have to say excuse me. I thought she might be pregnant, but I wasn't sure, not then. She was already a large girl, so it was difficult to tell exactly. But I worked all day there and went home after Frances ran her inspection and said I should come back the next day and do the upstairs. So I went on, and when I got to this little place we were staying in, I still can't believe this, but when I got there, I saw something that stopped me absolutely stone still. John Woodrow was there. Yes, he was surely back, just lying there on the cot, lying there propped up on a pillow, smoking a cigarette, and some girl not more than 16 was prancing up and down in front of him, wearing my nice underwear, modeling for him, wearing those things I'd carried around with me all that time, wrapped up in the tissue paper they'd come in, the nice things he tried to tear off me on our honeymoon. I'd washed those things and folded them back up and packed them away at the bottom of my bag where I didn't think he'd find them and ruin them. And there she was with them on, and that's not the half of it. She had little baby crawling around on the floor trying to keep up with her, with a diaper on I could smell from the door. I felt sick to my stomach. He saw me and she saw me, and they both were so drunk, or in this case, so sorry and so drunk, that they didn't even rush to cover up. He yelled out, "Ruby," but not like he'd been caught, like he wanted me to come in and join his party. I'd never been so disgusted in my life. I slammed the door and ran out and sat on the edge of the wheat field. I remember how the wheat felt so good to me, sad and angry as I was. And I sat there and said, what am I going to do about this? I wanted to kill him. To tell the truth, that's exactly what I wanted to do. But I knew I couldn't. I couldn't have lived with myself if I'd taken a life, even a life as worthless as John Woodrow's. But I said, you can hurt him. You don't have to kill him, but you can surely make him miserable. Migrant people got cut, shot all the time. Well, not all the time, but certainly enough for me to think if I shot John Woodrow in the leg or something, that I'd not be called to answer for it the way I would be if we weren't on the migrant circuit. And I thought if I played my cards right, provoked a fight with him, let some other people along that row of shacks hear it, I thought if I pushed him far enough, he'd explode and try to hurt me, and I'd defend myself. Then I'd have no choice but to pack up and go home. So I bought a pistol from a man and went back to that little shack, bound and determined to do some damage to old John Woodrow. When I got back to the house, John Woodrow and his girlfriend had cleared out and took my lingerie with them. But I said, that's all right, I'll wait. And I waited and waited, fell asleep that night with my clothes on, waiting for him to come in. But little did I know I'd seen the last of him. I went back to the Hoovers when I woke up the next morning and left the pistol hidden under my pillow. I didn't take it with me because having a pistol in a migrant house is one thing. Having it on you in the Hoovers' home would be another. See, one was society, the other wasn't. The rules are different, or there are rules in one place and none in the other. Frances had me clean everything but the light bulbs that day. I'd never had any experience cleaning a bathroom or a kitchen or even dusting a dresser. But you don't have to know how to clean. I learned that real fast. If you know what clean looks like, then you just take a mop or a broom or a rag and go at whatever's dirty until it's clean. That's that. And I knew clean. Sootie B could fly through a house, picking up things with one hand and cleaning under them with the other. She and Lester could roll up a rug, hang it outside, beat it, and lay it back down faster than a lot of people could vacuum one. She scrubbed our shower doors like they were something alive that had to be beaten back. Yes, I surely knew the meaning of clean. When Lonnie came in for lunch, I overheard her telling him all the things that she'd had me do, like taking everything out of the linen closet and wiping the shelves down. When he told her he doubted if anybody coming to the wedding would run a white glove in there, she said, "I know, but it seems like a shame to waste good seasonal help." Then she told him she wanted to have me working in the house, cleaning, keeping things in order, and then she told him she also wanted me to serve and pick up at Tiny Fran's reception. He said, "I thought you already asked one of the girls from the butler place," and she said, "I know I did, but I like the idea of having this girl better." All old Frances wanted to do was show off white help, a white girl walking around in her living room carrying a tray. And all I could think was how they'd be a new low in the life of Ruby Pitt Woodrow. Sootie B would never have put on a black dress and a little white apron and offered little sandwiches to people. But then again, nobody ever asked her to. She'd have brought her nephew Whistle Dick to serve and keep empty cups and plates picked up, not much different from what I did at Tiny Fran's wedding. I remember Mama and Daddy's anniversary party, how Sootie B picked out of the kitchen door and caught Whistle Dick tasting something off the buffet. He came back in and Sootie B told him, "Your mama say you ain't got good sense, so I let you work for me doing something don't take sense, and Mr. Pitt, he pay you good money, and then you be sticking your old fingers in somebody's food. You ain't got to be no nigger just cause you black, and ain't nobody in there going to ask you to wipe their nose. You just picking up plates. You mess up, and then what sister gwine do for money?" And all the time I was working at the reception, especially after I'd heard another one of Frances's remarks, it was all I could do to keep my fingers off the wedding cake. And the more I thought of Whistle Dick, the more I wanted to. Then I'd have been out, just like he was when Sootie B caught him sneaking the pineapple slices off a ham.
Ruby got here the week before Burr got married. Married to damn old Tiny Fran. And her already starting to poke out some with Roland. Lounging around all day, swinging in the porch swing, pulling out the front of her dress and blowing down it, yelling up to her mama's bedroom about how hot she was. Her mama used to tell her to go somewhere and cool off. She'd tell her, "I can't change the temperature. Big people get hotter faster, you know that." And that pissed Tiny Fran off, plump plus being pregnant. She'd hop up out of that swing and go inside, slamming doors, cussing like a sailor, saying how she's going to show her mama the back of her hand and so forth. She would, too. And I'd think, "Yeah, and either one of you let Lonnie know what all goes on, and he'll take and use one of you to beat the other one with." Lonnie Hoover was about as curious a man as you'll meet. Curious man, strange man. You'd watch him take something and take it until you'd be about to bust open to go in and snatch what was going wrong out from under him and fix it just to get the damn thing fixed in a hurry. Like if you knew who it was that took and borrowed a piece of machinery without telling somebody and then brought it back busted or just left it mired up in a field somewhere, you'd say, "When's Lonnie gonna make his move, get his business back in order?" But he'd move so slow and quiet, and then after what seemed like forever, you'd see extra bags of fertilizer packed back up under the shelter, or a brand new disc or mower pulled up beside the barn, and you'd say, "Well, it was about time," because you'd know Lonnie'd gone off somewhere with somebody and been made right with. Some quiet somewhere, Lonnie and a man had sat in a truck and made arrangements for Lonnie to get back what was his, and usually more. That's how he worked fixing Tiny Fran. Old Tiny Fran dragging around like a slug, leaving a trail, something else Lonnie'd have to clean up. I remember one time a long time ago, Ruby asked me why he hadn't just packed her up and put her away in somewhere to have that baby, or why he didn't pay a doctor off in town or somewhere under the counter to get rid of the whole business. Both of those quiet, slipping-around ways seemed to her like the way Lonnie liked to operate. But I said Lonnie was too sharp to fix something just for right now. No, Lonnie intended to wedge her in, clamp down on Tiny Fran for the long haul. Burr said he'd always remember how bright a day it was, how dry the dirt was deep down when he turned it up. He said that was what was on his mind, all he was thinking of, the bright day and the dry dirt, and then he looked up down a row and saw Lonnie walking across the way to him. He said when he got to the end of the row, he stopped the tractor, expecting to hear how Lonnie wanted him to do five more things before dark. But when the engine stopped, Lonnie just squatted down and started handling a dirt clod and told Burr to get down, they needed to talk. Burr heard Lonnie out. All the, boy, you might amount to something one day, and you might could be somebody if you had something behind you. To be sure you don't want to work for farmers.